Psalm 107. Oh, give thanks to the Lord, for he is good, for his steadfast love endures forever. Let the redeemed of the Lord say so, whom he has redeemed from trouble and gathered in from lands, from the east and from the west, from the north and from the south. Verse 8. Let them thank the Lord for his steadfast love, for his wondrous works to the children of man, for he satisfies the longing soul, and the hungry soul he fills with good things.
We're in Esther chapter 1. You can find that on page 410 in the Bible from the rack under the seat in front of you, or you can find it on your phone if you just want to look up the book of Esther online. It will help you immensely if you'll follow along. I'm virtually just going to read these two chapters, the first two chapters of the book, explain a little as we go along, and then surface the main point and apply it to our lives. Here we are at Christmas, the season of lights. I know it's the season of lights, and yet we've called our Advent series Waiting for Deliverance in the Darkness. Why? Well, two reasons. Christmas is historically positioned. Christians early in the beginning of Christianity in the early centuries chose a date right here in the end of the year, November, December, at the very darkest time of the year. So it's no historical accident that Advent, the season of light, comes when it is actually the season, naturally, of the greatest period of darkness. The reasons historically are a little bit murky, but we can generally ferret it out. The culture of ancient Rome, the pagan culture of ancient Rome, was known for celebrating December 25th and as a festival to the rebirth of the sun. The shortest day of the year had come just a few days earlier, December 21st, and by the 25th, you could notice the days were actually starting to lengthen. Again, the return of light, the return to the darkness. And Christians seized upon that festival and thought, all right, they're already gathering on the 25th of December, and we know all about the birth of the sun, S-O-N. And so it was then the historical date that Christians chose has almost nothing to do with the date when Jesus was actually born. But historically, Christians chose a date that comes to celebrate the birth of Jesus that comes at the darkest time of the year. They did it with good theological reason, though, too, didn't they? The shepherds were sitting in literal darkness when the glory of the Lord shone around them. And 700 years before the shepherds, the prophet Isaiah wrote, Chapter 9, verse 2, the people who walk in darkness have seen a great light. Those who dwell in a land of deep darkness, on them light has shone. It was true then, and it's true of us now, isn't it? The world is a dark place. One of the first lessons of Advent is that the world really is dark, darkened by curse, darkened by illness and death, darkened by confusion and foolishness and pride, and even our own sin. Here's one of the first lessons of Advent that we need to know. The lights of Advent are not a denial that the darkness is real. They're just confirmation that we're no longer alone in it. I expected a little more of something from you when I said that. So I liked how it sounded. Let me say it to you again. The lights of Advent are not a denial that the darkness is real. They're just a confirmation that we're no longer alone in it. Amen. I love that about Christmas. Let it be dark, because it really is a dark world. We're not pretending. We're just believing. All of which is why the book of Esther is a fitting companion for us this Advent. It's a story set in extraordinary darkness. God's people are exiles, living under the rule of a pagan empire. The king and his cronies in this book are ruthless, predatory, rapacious, and foolish, unbelievably foolish. Look around the world. We see plenty of Xerxes in our world today. And the Jews as a nation face an existential threat simply because they're Jews. It's a dark time indeed in this book. And what's more, the author who put this book together for us does little to change that tone. There's no word from God that pierces the night. No angels appear in glory. In fact, this book is unlike any other in the rest of the Bible because the name of God is never even mentioned. as though doubling down on that notion that it is a dark world. And yet, if you read carefully, you'll notice God's very much present. The author never announces what God's doing. He simply shows us the pieces that are being moved quietly, patiently into position as the darkness gathers. That's why we're calling the series Waiting for Deliverance in the Darkness. That's where we are, just like them. Because Esther teaches us something that Advent calls us to remember as well, that even when God seems absent, even when your world seems chaotic, even when the darkness feels like it's hanging right over your head, He's there. He's at work. He's already prepared the deliverance. He's already prepared the deliverance that we're waiting for. All that and more is what we'll see in our text for today. We're going to go through Esther chapters 1 and 2. We'll watch as a king loses his temper, a queen loses her crown, and an unlikely orphan girl is positioned by a hidden hand. The invisible king chooses her to a position that no one would have predicted. Sarah already read for us verses 1 through 12, so look back at them and I'll summarize what you see. Let me just point out a few things the author is doing. Look at verse 1. Now, in the days of Ahasuerus, the Ahasuerus, who reigned from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces. That's a big deal. India to Africa. His kingdom stretched as far as the known world. Sitting on his royal throne in Susa, not just in the city, in the citadel. He gave a feast for all his officials and servants. The whole army, the Medo-Persian army, was gathered with all of their forces. And look at verse 4. He showed the riches of his royal glory and the splendor of his pomp and greatness for a 6-month party. Yo. And when they got done, look at how he acknowledged the end of the party. Verse 5, when these days were completed, the king gave, for all the people present in Susa the citadel, great and small, another party, a feast lasting 7 days in the court of the garden of the king's palace. Verse 6 and following, you can see the opulence, the glory, the wealth, the splendor. White cotton curtains, violet hangings fastened with cords of fine linen and purple to silver rods and marble pillars, couches of gold and silver. Herodotus, the Greek historian, tells us that when Alexander the Great made his way into Susa, he was amazed by the stockpiles of gold and silver. I'm not telling you you should be amazed as you read this. I'm assuming you're already feeling amazed. Drinks were served, verse 7, in golden vessels, different kinds, royal wine lavished according to the bounty of the king. Apparently only fellows were invited. Verse 9 says, Vashti, the queen, gave a feast for the women in the palace that belonged to King Ahasuerus. Don't make any mistake. Her party was still hosted in property that he owned. He's the man. On the 7th, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded the 7 eunuchs who served in the presence of the king to bring Queen Vashti before the king with a royal crown to show the people and princes her beauty, because she was lovely to look at. So make sure clear in your head is who this main character is. He is the man. Unparalleled power. A kingdom that reaches to the edges of the known world. Unrivaled wealth. Unlimited wine and gold and silver. This is the man. Who can resist him? Let's keep reading. Verse 12. Queen Vashti refused. Wait, what? Queen Vashti refused. Who can resist him? Verse 12. His own queen. The person closest to him. The person who's supposedly the most loyal to him. The person that loves him the most. This cat can't even command his own wife. I mean, I don't know that any of us can, but you get what I'm saying. Even she won't do his bidding. So the story starts with this glory and opulence and wealth and splendor, and then slips in this dagger of irony that you can't even... Is there any real power in Susa? I don't know. Verse 12b, at this... The king became enraged, and his anger burned within him. Then the king said to the wise men who knew the times, for this was the king's procedure toward all who were versed in law and judgment, the men next to him, the seven princes of Persia and Media, who saw the king's face and sat first in the kingdom, he asked them, verse 15, according to the law, what's to be done to Queen Vashti because she has not performed the command of King Ahasuerus delivered by the eunuchs? Anytime you meet someone who refers to himself in the third person, be nervous about that guy. He gathers his seven advisors. And notice, here's a point that's going to come up with a little more importance later. These guys have direct access to the king. They see his face. When Esther is appointed queen, what does she have to do? She's nervous about going before him because if he doesn't raise the scepter, she could die. These guys have more authority than the queen. These are the men. And this great, powerful King Ahasuerus, you'll notice in this book, does not do one thing without asking for someone else's input. He comes up with no original ideas, except to get his queen to show off her beauty, and that doesn't go well. So he asks these guys. She hasn't performed the command of King Ahasuerus. What should we do? Then, verse 16, I'm going to read every other word now of chapters 1 and 2, because what you need to hear more than my words are the words of the Bible. So I'm mostly going to read, and then a few comments, till we get to the end. Then Memucan said in the presence of the king and the officials, not only against the king has Queen Vashti done wrong, but also against all the officials and all the peoples who are in the provinces of King Ahasuerus. Notice what he's saying. Bro, this isn't just a you problem. We all have wives like this. You're not the only one. He's stroking his ego. He's showing them this is a national crisis. Verse 17. For the queen's behavior will be made known to all women, causing them to look at their husbands with contempt, since they will say, King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him and she didn't come. Can you imagine? Oh no! Verse 18, this very day the noble women of Persia and Media who have heard of the queen's behavior will say the same to all the king's officials, and there will be contempt and wrath in plenty. Oh my goodness. If it please the king, let a royal order go out from him and let it be written among the law of the Medes, of the Persians and Medes, so that it may not be repealed, that Vashti is never again to come before King Ahasuerus. Wait, isn't that what she wanted? What a brilliant move. Why do fellas do this? This reminds me of that episode of The Office where Michael tries to fire somebody. Oh, no. Somebody quits. And then Michael goes, fine, I'll fire you, as though it has to be his idea. Giving the guy the very thing he wanted. This is what they do to what punishment should we give Vashti? How about if we tell her she can't come before the king? Wait, that's what she just wanted. Now, she can't come anymore is what they're saying, but these aren't brilliant advisors. Verse 19b. Let the king give her royal position to another who is better than she. Which means, should just do what you want. Verse 20, so when the decree made by the king is proclaimed through all his kingdom, for it is vast. Why say that? Unless he's just a brown noser, making this guy look like he's the man, you know? His kingdom, for it is vast. All women will give honor to their husbands, high and low alike. This advice pleased the king and the princes, and the king did as Memucan proposed. He sent letters to all the royal provinces, to every province in its own script, to every people in its own language, that every man be master in his own household and speak according to the language of his people. Doesn't matter where you're from, India to Africa, if you're a dude who's married, you're in charge now. The king said so. Okay, problem one in this story. What are we going to do about this incorrigible Vashti? Solution. King, how about if you tell her she can't come before you ever again and you get rid of her and you find a new queen? And by the way, that'll help all the men in the empire because all of them have wives who would love to be in charge. Oh, what's wrong with these guys? How insecure are these cats? How small are these men? They solve the problem by getting rid of the queen who said no. And by the way, A lot of Bible studies want to speculate about why Vashti didn't come. The narrator is not interested in that at all. Maybe she was drunk because she's holding her own party. Maybe he thought, maybe the implied message was, you come in a way that's going to objectify you. I mean, clearly that was happening, right? Just show off your beauty. We just don't know. And so it's pointless for us to speculate. The reason it's pointless is not we can't find the answer. The reason it's pointless is the narrator doesn't care that we understand why. He just wants us to know that there was a problem. Vashti wouldn't bow to the king, implying he has no power. And the way he got rid of it was to say, sure, fine, do exactly what you want, and you can never come before. And he's not going to like that solution for very long. Look at chapter 2, verse 1. Chapter 1, the theme is an old queen dismissed. Chapter 2, the theme is a new queen discovered. Verse 1. After these things, when the anger of King Ahasuerus had abated, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what had been decreed against her. What a clever use of the passive voice. What had been decreed against her. You can picture Ahasuerus in his chambers going, man, I kind of miss that queen. I wish that thing hadn't been decreed against her, as though someone else did it to him. Right? He's the one that did this. He misses her, apparently. Misses having that trophy wife on his arm. Verse 2, then the king's young men who attended him said, let beautiful young virgins be sought out for the king. And let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom to gather all the beautiful young virgins to the harem in Susa the citadel under the custody of Haggai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women. Let cosmetics be given to them. Let the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti. And this pleased the king, and he did so. So you understand what's being suggested. An empire-wide harvest of young virgins. And the king gets to pick the one he likes after she's well prepared. The narrator will tell us in a moment what that preparation process was like. And it gets even worse than you would imagine from that description. The first chapter is funny. The second chapter is profoundly tragic and horrible. But God's at work in all of it. To this point, though, in the narrative, if you're a thoughtful reader of the Bible, you're wondering, what does this have to do at all with the people of God? No person in relationship with God has been mentioned to this point. What does this have to do with the Jews? What does this have to do with you? Until you get to verse 5. Now, there was a Jew in Susa, the citadel, whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, son of Shimei, son of Kish, a Benjaminite. Don't miss his tribe. That isn't going to matter in chapter 2, but it matters a lot in chapter 3. Son of Kish, a Benjaminite, who had been carried away from Jerusalem among the captives, carried away with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had carried away. That exile, Jeconiah by Nebuchadnezzar, happened close to 100 years before this moment. So Mordecai wasn't directly carried away in that first exile. It was no doubt his parents, maybe his grandparents. But the point is, he, a Jew, is living in exile against his will, the victim of conquest. There's another Jew with him, verse 7. He was bringing up Hadassah, that is Esther, the daughter of his uncle, so they're cousins. For she had neither father nor mother. The young woman had a beautiful figure. Oh, this puts her in jeopardy, doesn't it? To this big reaping, this empire-wide harvest of beautiful women. She was lovely to look at, and when her father and her mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So a little glimpse in the empire of tenderness, light. A little Jewish family, two cousins. Presumably Mordecai, a good deal older, Esther dependent on him, and now vulnerable because of this nationwide search for someone who will please the king in all the superficial ways. In verse 8, the narrator starts to describe for us how this preparation process would work. When the king's order and his edict were proclaimed, and when many young women were gathered in Susa, the citadel, in custody of Haggai, Esther also, sure enough. Esther was taken into the king's palace and put in custody of Haggai, who had charge of the women. And the young woman pleased him and won his favor, this eunuch who's preparing the women to go seduce the king. He quickly provided her with cosmetics and her portion of food and with 7 chosen young women from the king's palace and advanced her and her young women to the best place in the harem. Esther had not made known her people or kindred, for Mordecai had commanded her not to make it known. We wonder about that, don't we? Some people take a position that says that was extremely shrewd, that allowed her to stay alive, that put her in position to be the rescuer of her people. Other people read that and go, Daniel and his 3 friends very clearly made known their Jewish identity in a very similar situation, and God preserved them. Should she have done that? The narrator shows no interest in that question. And so I won't either. I'm sorry. I am personally interested in it, but I'm not going to preach about that. Was what she did moral or immoral? Was it wise or was it wrong? The narrator doesn't comment on that at all, which, what does that do then? It simply heightens the tension about what's going on here and shows, oh my goodness, if anything good is going to come from this, God has to be the one doing it. Mordecai is certainly concerned about her well-being, verse 11. Every day, Mordecai walked in front of the court of the harem to learn how Esther was and what was happening to her. And here's how it goes when the girls meet the king. Verse 12. Now when the turn came for each young woman to go in to King Ahasuerus, after being 12 months under the regulations for the women, since this was the regular period of their beautifying, 6 months with oil of myrrh, and 6 months with spices and ointments for women, when the young woman went into the king in this way, she was given whatever she desired to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. In the evening, she would go in, and in the morning, she would return to the second harem in custody of Shazgaz, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the concubines. And she would not go into the king again, unless the king delighted in her and she was summoned by name. Now this entire contest is unmasked, isn't it? It's a sex contest. It's not a beauty pageant. It's who can please the king the most for the one night you get him in bed. Unless you think the women are the only ones whose sexuality has been objectified, this precious gift from God stolen away and used as a means of satisfying a rapacious king, lest you think the women are the only ones, what has happened to the sexuality of every single man in the story except Mordecai? Every single one of them is what? A eunuch. That's what kind of empire this is. The women are playthings to satisfy the king, and if he doesn't love them, if he's not wowed by them, if they don't do something to distinguish themselves as they please him sexually, they are relegated to the harem and never called again. No one's going to marry them. No one else is ever going to have sex with them, because that's actual treason. That's a claim to the throne. Remember when Absalom slept with David's concubines? These women are relegated to loneliness and exile the rest of their lives. One night of sex, and if they don't do it good enough, it's over for them. The eunuchs, never. Friends, let this book of Esther unmask the glory and splendor of the world to which we are all attracted. How are we possibly attracted to that disaster? The Persian Empire is not the first empire to jack up people's sexuality, is it? Verse 15. When the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his own daughter to go into the king, Oh. The narrator just slows all of that down and names all of her attachments to all of the important men in her life. And if you are a man, especially a husband, a dad, it should crush your heart. When the turn came for Esther to go into the king, she asked for nothing except what Haggai, the king's eunuch who had charge of the women, advised. She took the spices, the tricks, the lingerie. Now Esther was winning favor in the eyes of all who saw her, and when Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus into his royal palace in the 10th month, which is in the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. Do you remember when the first scene took place? The 3rd year of his reign. It's been 4 years that this long nationwide search and this preparation process has been happening, and now it's the big night. It bodes well for Esther that she's winning favor in the eyes of all who saw her, but how does it go? Verse 17, the king loved Esther more than all the other women. And she won grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins. So he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. I don't know if that's a win or a loss, but it's at least better than being relegated to the harem for one night, for the rest of her life after one night. And we know the rest of how this story goes, right? And so we're glad that Esther is in this position of influence. The Jews lift her up as a hero, and we're thankful that she was in this position. But don't miss the agonizing tragedy of what happened to get her there. Verse 18. Then the king gave a great feast for all his officials and servants. It was Esther's feast. Yeah, sure it was. He also granted a remission of taxes to the provinces and gave gifts with royal generosity. The king's feeling good. He found someone that satisfies his appetites. Verse 19. One more little note in this chapter. Esther is in a position of influence. That'll be strategic later. What about Mordecai? Verse 19. Now when the virgins were gathered together the second time, Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate. Esther had not made known her kindred or her people as Mordecai had commanded her, for Esther obeyed Mordecai just as when she was brought up by him. You hear, that's the second time the narrator's told us that. She doesn't say anything to anyone about being a Jew. Why? Because it's dangerous to be a Jew. This is a dark kingdom if you're one of the people of God. It'll become clear, more clear why in chapter 3, but for now, all we get is a note, a foreshadowing, a tone, that there's something about acknowledging that you're a Jew that would make it very dangerous for you. And so Mordecai tells her, don't tell anyone. Verse 21, in those days, as Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthan and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs, who guarded the threshold, became angry and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. So apparently, two of his bodyguards. This has happened multiple times in the history of humanity, hasn't it? Those responsible for the protection of the king decide they want to off him. Well, verse 22, this came to the knowledge of Mordecai, and he told it to Queen Esther, and Esther told the king in the name of Mordecai. When the affair was investigated and found to be so, the men were both hanged on the gallows, and it was recorded in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king. So Mordecai goes unrewarded, but at least he goes recorded in the book. So you have Esther in a position of influence, Mordecai in a position of influence. Where is this story going to go? Most of you know it, but for now, I just want to stop there, and we'll pick up chapter 3 next week. And I want to ask, what is the point of all of this? Well, we learned a lot about the darkness and depravity of the empire, but what's God doing? What's the main point of this story so far? Here's how I want to say it, that God's providence has prepared rescue even before you notice your need. God's providence has prepared even before you notice your need. The Jews have no idea that there will be a threat against their entire nation in a pretty short time. They don't know what's coming. But when it does come, there's someone in position and God put her there already. That's the lesson. that God readies the rescue before the danger even dawns. His provision always runs ahead of your peril. You should identify not with Esther. There are no Esthers in this room. And if there are, you are the only person in the entire country right now who holds that status. I mean, which of us is the linchpin for God's means of saving all of his people? That's what Esther is. So when we encourage our young daughters, hey, you need to be like Esther, we're doing something not only totally unrealistic for them, we're doing something wrong with the Bible. We don't identify with Esther in this story. We identify with the Jews who are hapless and don't even know what's coming. And when the danger comes, there's an Esther in position to save them. And oh, are they relieved. That's the point for us. That God's provision always runs ahead of your peril. You don't even know what's coming. But when you get there and it feels really dark, you will learn he's already provided what you need. See, what we're learning from the book of Esther is that God, when this disaster falls, doesn't have to improvise because he's already been orchestrating. He's designed all of this. The foundational doctrine through the book of Esther is called the doctrine of providence. It's the teaching that the living God sustains, guides, and directs all things, from galaxies to governments, from history's great events to the ordinary hours of your life, that God sustains, guides, and directs all things to accomplish his good and perfect will. It's not chance, as though the world were run by some cosmic roll of the dice. It's not fate, as though blind forces controlled what happens in your life. It's not even miracles, as though for God to show up, he has to split the sea every time. No, it's just providence. It's the quiet control of God using ordinary means, like natural laws and historical movements and human decisions, to achieve his extraordinary ends for his people. Using ordinary means to achieve extraordinary ends. He's using a foolish king who gets mad at his incorrigible queen, his resistant queen. And then he gets lustful. He could have any girl in the kingdom. He wants the trophy wife. And so he brings Esther and gets her. And all of that is God putting his person in position for just the right moment. God's providence prepares even before you notice your need. Some of you may be wondering, if God's in control of all these things and if he's so good, why does he allow the world to remain so dark? I know some of the darkness that some of you are dealing with, but there are a bunch of you that I don't know what the specific forms of darkness are. And so you might be thinking, why me in this darkness? Or as you look at the world, why that form of darkness? Why does he still allow that stuff? Why not just keep everything bright and better? No exile, no selfish kings, no hostile powers. Here's the thing. The book of Esther doesn't answer the question. And the rest of the Bible doesn't really either. Not in the way we'd like. There's no resounding mic drop answer to the problem of evil. But that doesn't mean it's not a valid or important question. It just means God believes we don't need that answer to be faithful while we wait. Because that's what we're doing, waiting in the darkness for deliverance. What God gives in these early chapters of Esther is a word that should be strong enough to sustain you. He gives this word that he is with his people. He is still in control, and he will deliver them in his way and in his time. And it's the exact same answer that we get from Advent, isn't it? Only brighter, clearer, even louder than anything we hear in Esther. In Advent, we hear God is with us. His timing is perfect, even before we knew our need. And his rescue comes in a form that we would never expect and can barely believe. Listen again to those verses from Isaiah that I read at the beginning and that we referred to in the song. Isaiah chapter 9, verse 2. The people who walk in darkness have seen a great light, and those who dwell in a land of deep darkness, on them light has shone. For a couple verses later, unto us a child is born. And to us, a son is given, and the government will be on his shoulder, and his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of peace? What kind of darkness are you bringing to this season of Advent? You feel lost and confused? He's your wonderful counselor, given, present, brightening the darkness. You feel weak and overwhelmed? He is your mighty God. You feel grief-stricken and alone? Let him be your everlasting Father. You feel anxious and restless? He is your Prince of Peace. This book of Esther gives Israel's rescue this profoundly unlikely name, Hadassah, Esther, a name that became precious to the people of God in the ensuing centuries. Well, the gospel gives your rescue another name, a name even less likely and even more precious. Remember what the angel said to Joseph? You will call his name Jesus. Why? Because he will save his people from their sins. Jesus means Yahweh saves. Call him that, because that's what's happening in him. And with that, the darkness begins to break, doesn't it? So what should we do with all this? Two applications. Two simple searching applications. Number one, don't be deceived. Let this story unmask the emptiness of the kingdoms of this world. The story shows us how the world's kingdoms flaunt power, parade wealth, objectify God's image bearers, distort God's good gift of sexuality, feed the empires of this world, feed their appetites, and they do all of that and call it glory. No. Let this story free you from the fantasy that God's people can ever receive help from those quarters. I'm not surprised no one said amen, but I'm going to say that again anyway. Let this story disabuse you of the notion that God's people will ever receive any kind of help from the kingdoms of this world. It will never happen, ever. There's no allies in Washington, zero, because they're wired just like Ahasuerus. The kingdoms of this world are loud and shiny and short-lived, and don't be fooled. Application number one, don't be deceived. And number two, don't be discouraged. There's no real power in Susa. None is there. This guy can't even get his wife to do what he wants. There's not a threat that God can't handle. There's not a plot that he can't overturn. All the kingdoms of this world are theater. It's all bluster. It's all pretense. And meanwhile, in the shadows, our God works to take care of his people, to deliver on his promises, to make sure they all get rescued, to make sure nothing happens to you outside of his good will. He's working in his providence before you ever knew you needed him. That's why Advent is a season of hope. It's why we can face the darkness and not be afraid, because the light has come. And we know, someday soon, the light will come again. Amen. Father, we pray that you would help us absorb the message of this great book. Let it relieve us of our hopes that are misplaced, and let it deepen our hope in Jesus, in whose name we pray. Amen.